This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Siviso, the It's Our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio with me. Today we have an interesting topic. We're discussing trauma and our response to road accidents. Mm-hmm. Malaysia has not done well at all. From what I understand, it's the fourth leading cause of death in 2018 and 2017. Our health and well-being, it's one of the, we're not doing very well. So we're also joining
just timely before Chinese New Year to talk about it, road safety, right?
Absolutely. And so in the studio with us also is a consultant emergency physician from Hospital Sungai Buloh, Dr. Shah Jahan Muhammad Yusof. He is very much, you'll never forget the man. He's linked to the Taj Mahal. What more can I say? Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
She's blushing.
I was just thinking, your parents may have been big fans of, Shah Jahan.
I'm not too sure about that, but
I'm pretty sure. I mean, it's a very unique name.
They haven't brought me there, though.
You have to go, at least, because you carry the name.
Pay homage to your name.
That's really. Dr. Shah Jahan, would you like to... What do people call you, Shah or Jahan? Or Shah Jahan?
At work, Shah.
Shah's all right. Okay. Shah, where do we stand in a global scale? Accidents, road accidents in Malaysia. I think we witness it. Oh, every one of us is at least witness to a road accident. One in 6 months, once in 3 months.
Yeah, right. That is, if you're lucky, I guess some of us tend to know people who are victims of road accidents even more frequently than that. Globally and even regionally, we're not seen to be doing that well. Mm-hmm. So we go by number of death per 100,000 population.
Okay.
And we stand at about 24 for every 100,000 population annually. And just to put in perspective, our southern neighbor, Singapore, is doing about 3.6 per 100,000 population. So, yeah.
This is what, 24 road accidents or 24 deaths?
Per 100,000.
Unfortunately, these are death for...
Per 100,000.
Per 100,000, meaning which the accidents and the other morbidities such as fractures, injuries, which don't lead to death,
are excluded much, in much higher than
not that. Accounted for in here.
Yeah.
Anyone doing worse than us? I shouldn't be looking at that, but I'm just very curious.
Yeah, African nations are getting about 30 over.
You can see Shawit giggling away, African nations. So in Southeast Asia or in ASEAN countries?
We have around similar numbers with Vietnam.
Okay.
Thailand just about just a little few percent above than us. Indonesia has clocked about 12.2 for every 100,000
population. That's fantastic.
Population.
It's half. It's half of ours.
Lots of good things are perhaps improving there.
Yeah.
So that's about how we are doing regionally.
I'm very curious, what is Indonesia doing so well?
These are statistics, of course, that we have to take to account the element of probable underreporting as well, which we can't rule out. But otherwise, I think they're taking very aggressive steps of late into reducing casualties on the roads through various steps.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we cannot compare ourselves with other countries. The demographics are very different.
Mm-hmm.
So they have their challenges. We have ours.
What are our challenges? I'm very curious. I mean, we have great roads. We have many cars. What is it? It's attitude.
Multitude of
multifactorial. So politician, right? The answer, right?
Potholes.
Okay. Problems. Well, to put it very simple, you can probably divide it into preventive problems, as well as the actions that we can take medically once the accident happens. Both ways to reduce death.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So essentially. Preventive problems will be mainly the way people drive and also the condition of the roads.
Yeah, we have a lot of road safety rules that we have put in place. Matter of fact, we are among the countries to have among the most rules. But the problem perhaps lies on the implementation of these rules.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is where all the rules become of almost no use. And we have speed limits which we do not strictly adhere to.
Yes, and so there's no consequence as well, isn't it? Enforcing is one thing, but then the consequence is not effective enough as well. You know, how many people you pass by who are still on their mobile phones as they drive, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's one simple thing people can stop doing, actually.
Yeah, and many, many more. That boils down to the attitude part of the of our civics, and whether to or not for the public to follow these rules also depends on how these rules are being enforced. And if we have a lot of human factors, I would like to say, in when these rules are not implemented very strictly.
Mm-hmm.
For example, maybe some feel that you can get away from a roadblock, or even if you get caught by a cop or whatnot. So therefore, that fear of having to actually adhere to these rules do not are not well translated.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to certain countries, what they have done is to remove the human factor out of implementation of these rules.
Why?
So they go on automation. For example, if you are caught for speeding, you can either be caught by a cop, which may
be negotiable.
There's a lot of human factors that come into play. And
I love that human factor.
Otherwise,
you are a true politician, right?
I'm trying to keep my words.
That's right. Yeah.
Simple.
Not get into trouble. That's right, yeah.
As opposed to if you've gotten caught by a traffic camera, which you can't get away with, and that's automation. And we do have speed cameras, traffic light cameras in Malaysia. However, they can be easily identified by, you know, you have certain apps that tells
Absolutely.
You exactly where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you know exactly north to south highway, you know exactly where the cameras are. So it makes them, again, very ineffective.
Right. So preventive measures, what else in terms of...
So if you're going to implement cameras and automation, it has to be throughout. For example, every 5 to 10 kilometers throughout the highways or throughout the major roads and etc. So that way, you are assured that the road users are definitely going to be keeping to those limits.
Okay, that's very... But, you know, enforcement aside, we do know, you know, enforcement in general, we're not the best at it in any area in this country. we can always do better in enforcement. But I've always felt that how much enforcement is actually required... given the population, how many people do you need to have to keep everyone in check? That's absolutely crazy. Doesn't make sense to me. Why do you think our attitude is such in the first place? I think we need to figure that out, George. I think
I'm sure you're in the front line seeing how horrible it is when somebody is met with car accident, polytrauma. And I think the people, the attitude towards that, they don't really first time experiencing that, and then so it's not a deterrent. So when people are not really seeing the consequence and detrimental effect that it has for the rest of the young productive life of these drivers or their passengers or their loved ones, it's difficult for them to imagine what difference does it make just to speed that extra 10 kilometres per hour.
Dr. Shah, you're in the front line, you see this. What have your observations been?
it's rather sad because for the patient and the victims, is of course it's a bigger tragedy. And but for us, we see it almost every day. Actually, some succumb to it, some suffer grave consequences, although they are alive, but they will be severely debilitated if they go through and survive the resuscitation. There is, it's a lot of work having to be put into the entire process of receiving these trauma patients. And the one that takes the biggest toll is going to be the family members.
Yes.
Especially when so that most of the trauma actually happens, more than half of them, for patients below 40, 18 to 40 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the
mainly
young...
Mainly men.
Mainly men, actually, you're right, about 90%.
And, wow.
And
That's a risk-taking behavior in you guys.
Right? No, it doesn't include me because I'm way above 50 now.
Oh, that's a second higher category number.
The midlife crisis and the sports car. Yeah,
between 40 to 65.
You forgot the Vespa and the pothole,
right,
George.
The Vespa and the pothole, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a shame because this is the generation that our country needs. This is the intellect of the future of the country.
The productive group,
And even if you're on the roads, even if you're on a car or motorcycle, and if you're careful, somebody else may not be.
True.
So it's not always
the infrastructure may not be up to maintenance or up to scratch.
That too, in some areas as well. And there's a lot that can be done to improve on that gap.
So what are the common reasons behind these road accidents? Is it speeding? Is it unsafe roads? Is it distracted driving? Is it driving under the influence of, you know, it's substance abuse?
Alcohol.
You've already spoken about enforcement, which is one issue.
Yeah. Substance abuse is not the highest on the list. It's more about speed. As they say, speed kills. And also, for different roads, you have different speed limits. And most of the road traffic deaths are contributed by motorcycles as opposed to cars, actually. Simply because for cars and motorcycles, they share the same speed limit, of which is ironic because cars have higher amounts of safety mechanisms put into it as opposed to a motorcycle where you are almost bare naked to injury. And somehow both of these vehicles share the same speed limits, so that itself doesn't make sense. So when a motorcycle travels at higher speeds, and they tend to get more severe injuries when they come into collision as opposed to a car, and therefore obviously them being the highest contributors to death. Secondly is also the roads, the conditions of our roads, and adherence to special lanes that give motorcycle lanes or bus lanes and car lanes are, again, very loose. They are implemented in some places, but again, not in certain other places. So it's very patchy. And
George, you just want to, on that note, you want to just share your experience?
Well, I, three years ago, I actually, I don't know what got into me and then decided to ride a scooter. Most people think if I'm on a motorbike, it will be a big Harley Davidson, but a tiny Vespa that actually went from Hatamas area to Ampang. And actually, on the highway, it was all right, but on the smaller road, lots of potholes, and that's exactly what happened. And then hit the pothole, the bike landed on me, ended up rupturing my spleen, torn my liver. And then glad to survive that, you know. I'm very, very thankful. And clearly it changed my life, because you realize how fragile it is. I mean, interesting enough, I was just operating on a patient who had a ruptured pelvis earlier on today. Essentially, young man, 28 years old, involved in a car accident, similar to what I succumbed to, and then essentially fractured his pelvis. And that itself, after 2 years of multiple operations, he is not working, his confidence is rock bottom, he's plagued with infections after infections of the interventions. And I realized that I was on that thin line of everything would have changed for the worse. And for many, many people, that was the case. And what for? It was simply because a pothole that was considered to be completely harmless and benign. And I really think something like potholes like that, the number of people who are killed or injured or badly injured by that is so unreported, underreported.
So unsafe driving being one. What else?
Yeah, just to add to that, Dr. George, you're very right to say that many people do not see the back end of it. We only close the story at the accident. And you know, we feel sorry, but the time, the resources, as well as the emotional turbulence that the family and the patient himself goes through or her throughout after that, is actually very, very debilitating. Mm-hmm. And you're very lucky that you came out of it and whatnot.
That's right.
Right. But yeah, that's the burden of trauma to our population today. And we don't, all of us think that this will never happen to me.
Yes.
Never
happen
to I imagine myself not insured, but, you know, the ICU expenses per day was about 8,000 ringgit. And then that is excluding any of my doctor's colleagues' charges because those were the necessity to save my life. Following the injury, I was advised not to work for 3 months because the injury itself was just so severe that you know, I needed to give time for the liver and spleen to recover. And imagine if I did not have the buffer or the insurance, that could easily tip me into bankruptcy. Very easily, and that will affect the rest of the family.
So financially, how do patients in Hospital Sungai Buloh, for an example, where you work, how do they manage the cost? And of course, there's this cost that, you know, we don't calculate usually, which is on a country level.
Most of the population are not on insurance. It's a very small number of margin of people who can actually afford the premiums to benefit from private healthcare and insurance. Sungai Buloh is part of the Ministry of Health Hospital. Within the Ministry of Health structure, the medical cost is almost negligible, if not free. And this is what is part of the provision to the people. And if you are involved in a major trauma, an accident, the likelihood of you being brought to a hospital will be a Ministry of Health hospital, mm-hmm. simply because of the 999 activation system brings about a government 999 response ambulance. And you'll be brought into the trauma system of what we have and to the nearest hospital to be treated. Cost-wise, it is a real burden for the government to treat these patients, especially more so the longer, the more severe the injuries are and whatnot, ICU costs, you know, that are escalating, especially nowadays. Aside from all that, it's also the
rehab afterwards.
Right. The rehabilitation process, the care and et cetera, and the government provides almost everything for free. So as you can imagine, it's a lot.
Do we have a rough estimate as to how much it costs?
It's quite difficult to cut out exactly and how much exactly it costs, but total healthcare, I think, rises up to 60 billion a year, partly by insurance, mostly by government, some by personal payments and etc. In total, the whole country, you can probably say about by value of statistical life, if you put at 7,000 death per year at current value of statistical life, it's about 1.4 million per life. You're losing at about near 10 billion a year.
Wow.
On trauma alone.
Yeah, that's 10 billion ringgit.
Take out the cost of morbidity just from death. If you put a human life to a number, at average in this country, it's about 1 to 1.4 million. And that's the number that you get. And these numbers are not accounted onto the ledgers.
No.
These are numbers that we are losing, actually.
10 billion ringgit
a year. And it's an estimate cost. And it's rising. And
that's not even looking at loss of productivity for the country. And, you know, all of that is not factored in at all.
Yes, some of those factors are factored in, but that's the cost we are looking at. Yeah.
Okay. 10 billion.
It is, yeah. I mean, of course, the family side, you know, for example, if there's only breadwinners that is affected, and then the money, even you have reasonable amount of savings, will run up quite quickly when the main income earner for the family is not really generating any income.
I mean, it's weird, isn't it? We focus on 22.3 billion, are we?
Mm-hmm.
But 10 billion is half, almost half of that, more than half of that. So, wow, we need to get our priorities right. We are discussing trauma and response to road accidents in this country. Dr. Shahjahan Mohammad Yusuf, a consultant emergency physician from Hospital Sungai Buloh, in the studio with us, together with, of course, our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasuthi in our Health and Living segment, our Doctor in the House series, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. Joining us also, Dr. Shah Jahan Muhammad Yusuf, a consultant emergency physician from Hospital Sungai Buloh. We are discussing trauma and road accidents. Well, just to go through some facts with you that Dr. Shah Jahan has actually shared with us. We experience 24 deaths per 100,000 population. We're not doing well at all in the largest, in globally.
We're doing better than African nations.
Yeah, we're slightly doing better than African nations. Thailand doing only, and Vietnam doing only a little worse than us. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, yeah. So people most vulnerable amongst the population for this death, these deaths are motorcyclists.
Right.
Many between the ages of 18 and 40 years old who are male, speeding being the number one reason, unsafe roads being the second reason why these things happen. Cost us about 10 billion ringgit a year to actually deal with this problem.
Yeah, 10 billion in loss of life.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, let's just talk about, you have mentioned there are two aspects to this. One is, you know, getting the patient to the hospital or trauma, the golden hour of trauma when the accident actually happens, before they actually come to the hospital and there's a response team from there. Could you just talk to us about the both, the importance of what you call the golden hour after a traumatic injury?
Yeah. So it is very important that subsequently after an injury takes place, that treatment occurs as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And the golden hour is not typically 60 minutes or not. It's a metaphor to say that, you know, the earlier period that we should intervene is a very narrow window. Mm-hmm. And if we miss that window, we will be very subjected to many other complications that subsequently we need to chase down in order to resuscitate the patient, and that makes it harder. So the faster we start treatment, the better the outcome is going to be. So the concept of the golden hour is generally put.
Presumably this is in principle of ATLS, which is the, you know, acute trauma, life support kind of like principle, right? Would you like to share with the listeners out there what is this sort of like principles when patients get brought to accident emergency department?
Yeah. ATLS, it's just a short for Advanced Trauma Life Support. And that's American college teaching. So it's a global teaching. So every countries have different demographics. So in Malaysia, it's the Trauma Life Support Malaysia program. And technically, all what these programs do is to provide an approach which is beneficial for the masses, and how medical officers can actually provide initial care, resuscitation, which typically the airway, breathing, circulation, components, and try to minimize causing secondary injuries and subsequently allowing the best chance for the patients to recover. Mm-hmm. So it's a process, a trained process.
But if the golden hour is most important,
yeah,
and that would mean the ordinary person on the road who's going to try and save this person, what are some of the things you feel we should know about helping an accident victim?
Before anything is said and done, it's always the universal precaution that we have to, before we save or attempt to save somebody else, make sure the environment is safe. Yes. Do not put yourself into a situation where potentially you will be the next victim.
True. People, you know, are so focused on saving other people's lives, not realizing that, you know, running into the middle of the highway when the cars are still speeding is not exactly the brightest thing to do.
Yeah, not the best thing to do, definitely. Yeah. Then you have two victims. So aside from that, once you take that out of the equation, then it's always an assessment of the patient's condition. As a lay person, there's technically not very much that you can do, but more important things that you can do, if you can see the patient, you can move the patient out from a dangerous environment safely, that's something that the public can do. Secondly, if you see bleeding, which is torrential, open bleeding, you can provide compression to the area which is bleeding.
Yeah.
And if you have a bit more training, then perhaps you can provide immobilization to certain limbs that are fractured, or even the neck and all that. So that can help.
This is always the obstacles a lot of bystanders get worried about, right? You know, because moving the victim might cause more harm. Can you elaborate a little bit or give tips a little bit for bystanders who attended to a patient or somebody who's been knocked over by a car or something? Should they move the patient or should they not move the victim?
That's always the golden question.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's not the same answer for all scenarios. Typically, if the patient is in a safe area, then there's no real need to move the patient. If the patient can actually move himself, then that's the best, of course. We are talking about patients who probably can't move. But if the patient's in the middle of the highway, and it makes a lot of sense to actually prioritize to get the patient out of the danger area. And if you have to do so, it is very important to make sure that the neck or the cervical spine is immobilized and does not have any too much rotational movements or flexion or extension movements. And this can be done only if you have more than one person trying to help out.
True.
Typically, one person holding the neck from the back and another one or two people trying to carry the body as a plank.
Okay.
As a plank. Yeah. Okay. I think we've done shows with Dr. Rajesh on severed fingers or, you know, and how to get that part into ice, not in direct contact with ice, but in a cold environment and get it to the hospital. I think that's important as well.
If you have an amputated portion of your limbs, exactly, not with direct ice.
Yep.
Not like what we do with poultry in the fridge. But
we always assume it's the same thing, isn't it?
It's not the same, definitely. What the best thing to do is to, number one, what you want to do is keep it in a cool environment. So ice is naturally the source of keeping an environment cool, but you don't want it direct contact. So you put it into a separate bag. Fold it nicely so that it's protected from being frosted by the ice.
Right.
But at the same time, it's damp and kept in a cool environment.
Okay, so most of us are not driving around with ice.
That's right?
So what do we do then?
Go to 7-Eleven, get some ice.
Well,
that makes sense.
If it's nearby.
Yeah.
But otherwise, just do with what you have. Put the part of the portion in a clean bag and transport it to the hospital as fast as you can. So that way the ischemic time is running, but you can keep the limb cool once it reaches the hospital. Okay. I don't even know what to do.
Do you think we have the best system in place when it comes to trauma and emergency? Like the work that you do, for an example. Do you think we have the best system in place to...
to receive these victims.
Yes, yeah. and ensure that, you know, their lives are... you know, we're able to help them.
Yeah, that's a very leading question. So I'll be honest, if we had one, then I guess our numbers would not be at 24 in 100,000. There's
good point.
a lot of space to improve. And until and only that we realize and agree that there are gaps that we have, then we can take actions on it.
I mean, sure. The two points that I probably took away from what you said earlier on is that we're probably in par with Vietnam. It's probably because of motorcycles, usage. If I've been to Vietnam, and you know that motorcycle is quite prevalent. And the other thing which I'm really interested in is that in comparison with Singapore, it's a small city state where access to immediate trauma care will be a stone's throw away in all directions. How many proportions of the death toll of all the fatalities are actually outside urban areas? Because a lot of rural access after trauma may not be so fast. For example, if it's on the highway, 25 kilometers away from the nearest cities, that's always not comparable to Singapore.
Yeah,
and not that just. Can I just add on? Our ambulance services leaves much to be desired. We have to get our act together with our ambulance services. What's happening there?
Yeah, not just the ambulance services, it's the entire system. Ambulance is just part of it. What we have now and what we are trying to achieve is two different things, of course, and currently we are in the midst of it. we realized that the pre-hospital trauma activation and trauma reception in Malaysia is, as you say, as much desired to be improved. But how are we going to do that? And that's where the challenge is. The question is, why hasn't the care of trauma improved over the years? We've been in this business for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But why are we still here? I think it boils back down to trauma being a bit unique because there are too many players. For example, just the prevention care alone will require a multitude of organizations to work together and to be on the same page. And that's very challenging in our environment. You need MIROS, JPJ, police, for example, all to sit down together, even the healthcare organizations, to come out with a plan, and all of them need to sync. In the medical aspect, you would need the pre-hospital care ambulance, the emergency and trauma services, the surgical practice of various disciplines, intensive care, rehabilitation, everybody to sit in sync. And this is hard to achieve,
mm-hmm.
To get everybody on the same page, especially so when there is no real top-down, aggressive initiative to want to achieve this. And it's not only from the Ministry of Health. There are more than one ministries that are required and would be required to make this entire thing successful. So it has to be a central government agenda. For example, we want to target a reduction of so many much percent in the next 1 or 2 years. And this is something we all have to achieve. A special task force is created to put everybody in check, get the RCA, what's the root cause, and address every issues. And that's probably the only way we are going to achieve a reduction. Otherwise, there's no good news in this.
Are we not doing it already?
No, we are doing it, but in silos. I think Ministry of Health is coming out with a national trauma policy, which will put everybody into sync, but it's still not released at this point of time. Mm-hmm. It's in the final drafting stages.
Okay, we'll come back and find out a bit more about the trauma policy, as well as we used to have a national trauma database,
mm-hmm.
And whether or not that database that was launched in 2006 still exists and whether or not it's serving any purpose. We'll come back and find out more. If you have a question, call us on 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We have Alex on the line. Alex, just stay with us. We'll come back and get your question up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to our Doctor in the House series. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio with me, together with Dr. Shah Johan Muhammad Yusof, a consultant emergency physician from Hospital Sungai Buloh. We are discussing trauma response to road accidents, just trying to figure out how we're dealing and managing this death rate of 24 per 100,000 population. Malaysia not doing very well on a global scale. Forget the global scale, but we're just not doing well for our own people. We're doing a disservice for our people. Many stakeholders involved, as you mentioned, Dr. Shah. It's just not a one-stop situation where health is in Ministry of Health is responsible. It's many stakeholders across the board. As you've mentioned, everybody working in silos, not coming together to solve this problem is a big challenge. If you have a question for us, what's the number to call, George?
Okay, studio number is 03 7 7 7 3 2 900, or WhatsApp it on 018 789 8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Fantastic. We have Alex on the line. You have a question, Alex.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, I just have a question. I mean, we're talking a little bit about bystanders just now, right?
Yes.
So I'm actually first aid certified, but then I have heard stories of people not willing to help out in accidents like this because of liabilities. You know, what if when I try to help the person that's in trauma, but I accidentally kill them, for example? Is there any law to really protect people like us? Then at least there'll be more people more willing to voluntary help out.
Okay. Good point. Thank you very much, Alex. Thanks for that.
Yeah, Alex, I think that's a really something important to highlight out. Just a disclaimer before that, I'm not an expert in law, but from what I use and practice, in the US there's Good Samaritan law, which protects all such conditions where an intent to help was actually the primary aim. In Malaysia, we do not have the Good Samaritan law, but the principles of that law still are practiced and applied. Mm-hmm. So up to date, as far as we know, there is still no such case that is a precedence of such that somebody is being sued for trying to actually help someone and etc.
So it's never happened?
To my knowledge, until today. However, I think this is a concern because such misnomers get the public to want to not help now, rather than to actually provide assistance that they can, and that assistance, for all you know, is the golden hour intervention, simply to stop the bleed by compression, perhaps. And I think that should not be the main worry. Things should be done in good intention, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think Malaysians are becoming, have less empathy towards accident victims?
Yeah, actually, in my personal opinion, I think it is. We are heading that way. Mm-hmm. Not just because of the factor of worry of litigation, but I think it's also the worry of biohazard precaution.
All right. Yeah. About getting contracted some sort of infection through bloodborne.
Right. I think that's also quite a significant concern.
Mm-hmm. Should that be a concern?
That's rightfully a concern, if you ask me, of course. Always try to have the best protection. If you have gloves, wear gloves. Otherwise, wash your hands immediately. Mm-hmm. Make sure there's no cuts and bruises if you are handling with blood.
One thing I always get me really disappointed is, all these accident pictures circulating around on WhatsApp and things. I think Malaysian has this really awful, awful attitude. Whenever there's an accident, they will either go with their handphone and start taking a recording of what happened, gory pictures and circulating around. I think that's really quite off-putting. And the other thing that, you know, the older generation probably will go and look for the number and then go and buy buy a call or something.
I was just going to say, we see less of that.
That's right. But older generations will probably do that.
Yeah, but we're seeing more of this picture taking, and you know, my observation in general, motorcyclists have more compassion than people who drive cars when it comes to helping people, accident victims.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can generalize that. That's very dependent on our personal experience of what we've seen. We've also seen motorcyclists coming, you know, taking advantage and taking the handphone and jewelries and just moving away. We've seen that too. So there's... I don't think that's something
difficult
that we
to generalize. Because when I met with my accident, I was lying in a tower and lying on the roadside for about 20 minutes without anyone stopping. So I walked to the hospital because my phone was actually damaged. I couldn't call the ambulance. So I walked to the hospital.
Are you kidding me?
No, I didn't. It's like
nobody
I walked
came
for
forward to help.
No, I was just lying there next to the motorbike for 20
minutes.
Maybe
they knew who you were. That's what I'm
Probably.
The importance of first
Dr. George.
Aid. they wouldn't have recognized you in that.
Yeah,
helmet,
because
George.
Half of my face is gone.
Yeah, no, you right. Look like Mr. Bean in that
That's
helmet.
That's right, yes.
Importance of first aid. What do you think?
Yeah, it's very important. Definitely. Providing, a matter of fact, in the policy, a national trauma policy to come, I'll just give you a small sneak preview on the emergency medicine aspect of it. First aid by passerby is part of the thing that we'll probably be promoting as well. Because there's no way that we can get the healthcare rescuers immediately by your side in the next 5 minutes. It's a very, very daunting task. So the nearest and closest person next to you is the person next to you.
Yes.
And that's the member of the public. Of course, it includes... NGO officers, RELA officers, police, bomba, and etc. But aside from that, it's the layperson. And the more that the layperson is trained to provide initial first aid, the more that we can actually help each other in the community aspect of medical care.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's education that's lacking? That, you know, Malaysians need to understand the importance of first aid. It just doesn't have to be accidents, actually. It's accidents everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, education is probably lacking across the board right now.
Don't ask who in this room knows first aid. I'll be quite embarrassed. Okay,
and that should be introduced very early in the education system, in schools, secondary schools, not just to, if you are a member of St. John's, for example, or Bulan Sabit Merah, it should not be just limited to that level of involvement, but it should be generally taught in schools
and updated.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
We have a question from someone who's texted in. Any plan to include a doctor along the med assistant when attending ambulance call for early interventions, since we have a surplus of doctors now?
Yeah. Interesting question. It's to put a doctor, I mean, to say surplus of doctors also, you need, for you to be in the ambulance to provide the kind of care that is required, requires training, mm-hmm. Specialized training for that. And not all doctors are trained for that. Meaning which, again, we need to train the new surge of doctors that are coming mm-hmm. in. And it doesn't take 1 or 2 days. It takes a lot of time. So currently what happens is that there's no doctor for every response. Mm-hmm. But responses that are requiring such special interventions are provided with doctors in case-to-case basis yes. at current point already. And that is triaged by the Medical Emergency Call Center, mm-hmm. which is quite an organized infrastructure. Mm-hmm. When you call in, the call is triaged by a system. And if the call code is of high priority and different ambulances are dispatched as opposed to
yes.
not.
Yeah. I mean, I remember I just called 999 very recently and yeah. I was really quite surprised when the lady asked me if there was somebody who was injured.
Yeah,
they were not going to come if there were no injuries. You know, in the UK, I remember I was in one accident and the ambulance was there within minutes and they even were treating whiplash.
Yeah.
And that's something so simple, which you wouldn't know whether it's an injury or not.
Right, right, right.
But that's not taken into consideration. And she was not going to dispatch the ambulance until I told her that there was an injury or not. Yeah. So,
but most Malaysians would just turn around and say there was an injury regardless, right? Because if you want an ambulance to dispatch you,
I was thinking, George, mm-hmm. I couldn't do that because I would be depriving somebody who somebody really else, had an injury yeah. From that
really
service.
Needed.
Absolutely.
Right.
So yeah. I had to go and check and ask if there was an injury, and there was no injury. So the ambulance never came.
It's also the optimization of whatever little resources yeah. that there is at this
True.
Point.
Yes. So that's what I'm saying. We don't have the resources. As you said, right. it's mm-hmm. multi, you know.
Yeah.
Stakeholder, we need to prioritize this mm-hmm. at some stage. Let's talk about the national trauma policy very quickly,
yeah.
Dr. Shah. What can yeah. we? What is it, and what can we expect from it?
So, currently, when we talk about whenever you have an accident or any other emergency as well, accident and trauma in this case, you are sent to the nearest hospital,
mm-hmm.
basically. So we find that is inappropriate because causes in some cases more harm than not.
Right.
So what should be done is. In any case of trauma, and the type of trauma should be assessed, and you should be sent to the nearest, most appropriate hospital, as opposed to just the nearest hospital.
With trauma center.
Yeah, or depending on the level of the center, which we will define within the policy, and depending on the injury. So the assessment of injury will determine the level of care that you will require. And therefore, when possible, you'll be sent directly to that particular center, although it may just be another 5 minutes or 10 minutes further.
Mm-hmm.
But it saves a lot more time than having to go to a smaller hospital and subsequently having an inter-facility transfer to a larger center. And that, at average, causes a delay of at least more than 4 hours,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to that 10 or 15, 20 minutes.
That will not solve your problem of resources, though.
That will not solve the resource problem, but it will actually help out in that golden hour period of treatment, which will benefit the patient subsequently. Resource-wise, there's no solution unless we get more resource.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as much as we can is to optimize current resources, which I think we are already running thin on that, and we are at best
mm-hmm.
Of its level of optimization.
And given that, I suppose we, the general public, can play a huge role.
Yes.
In that whole.
Yeah, by
scheme of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely by screaming out loud and asking the central government to help us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Besides the trauma policy, does it go hand in hand with other policies, for an example?
Sorry?
The national trauma policy, does it stand alone or does it need to go hand in hand with other policies, for an example?
It needs to be in sync, definitely. So in the national trauma policy, you have not just one specialty, you mm-hmm. have almost all relevant specialties to trauma care
right.
sitting on the same table and seeing how each can facilitate the other
mm-hmm.
In a seamless way. So there's something that we want to introduce, the Malaysian trauma chain of survival concept, of which we call it a chain because simply why? The entire chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Mm-hmm. So meaning which, we recognize the fact that not only one particular field is important, but in order for a patient to have the best chance of survival, everybody in every specialty and every segment of the field needs to be enhanced.
Mm.
And if only if one is weak, it makes the entire chain weak. So the concept is to enrich and empower the entire chain.
So on that line of thought, who actually take charge of the management of polytrauma patients? Because in many countries, orthopedic surgeons are the ones who kind of take the lead because there are a lot of bony injuries. In Malaysia, do we have a kind of trauma physician only deal with multi-trauma?
Yeah, there the trauma physician and trauma surgeon training program development has just started.
And that's different from what you are, an emergency physician?
No, I'm an emergency and trauma physician. So for you to do a trauma surgery or trauma physician program, it's a subspecialty. Okay. So you have to be either emergency physician or general surgeon, then subsequently you do your subspecialty. Well, but putting that aside,
Does that mean you don't have much of a life?
Oh, well, I'm here with you.
That's so that's good life, right? That's what I tell myself every Friday.
But your emergency.
Yeah, well, it's a choice you make, I guess.
So but you work in shift work, right? I mean, presumably.
Sometimes. Yeah. Some days in shift, some days in office hours, and some days.
I disrupted your train of thought on the policy.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you did actually. Where
were we were talking about who takes the lead for the trauma management.
Right. Yes.
So there's no one particular specialty that takes the entire lead. It depends on which phase you are. So all of the patients come into the entry point pre-hospital care, and then they come to the emergency first. If you're under the roof of the emergency department, the trauma team leader is the emergency physician or trauma physician if you have one. And subsequently, once you have a primary team and you're either in the ICU or in the OT, then the primary team takes over leadership. So it's a baton that you
pass on,
right? So it depends what injury you have. And you were saying orthopedic surgeons used to take charge back in the days, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And but that has changed a lot of late because even in orthopedics, there's a lot of subspecialties, not necessarily just trauma alone. Mm-hmm.
If there's a model of trauma care that you would like to emulate, which country would it be?
I don't think that there is... we cannot duplicate a system from one country, put it right on our map and expect it to work equally. I believe that... every country has its unique needs. We need a system of our own. It may not be one particular country that we need to emulate, but maybe a hybrid of few countries that we take the best of it and see what works best.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Australian system is quite good. They're kind of down south there, and some of the demographics are similar to how we work. A bit of the American system also, and a bit of the UK system that... we need. So it's a very unique thing. For it to be at the most efficacious state, it needs to be self-made because only then it can cater 100% to our needs. That's what the policy is about.
Are you confident the policy will be out soon?
The amount of time that we're spending on it?
Eventually.
Eventually. Once it's out, getting everybody on the same page is challenging. However, once it's out, I believe that it's definitely a significant first step towards having better outcomes for our trauma patients.
Okay. What would you like to leave us with?
Well, not just to leave you guys. I think the final message I would like to leave all of us is trauma. It's almost a forgotten disease. So until and only then that we start recognizing that it is the highest cause of premature death in this country, only then we can start taking action on it. And for us to start taking action, everybody needs to be working together. We should stop this silo capacity of how we work over the past years, because that obviously did not work. And aggressive action needs to be taken by the central administration. It's not just one ministry. It has to be a government agenda. And if we want to really reduce 7,000 deaths every year, which I think it's putting in some amount of money on infrastructure and whatnot, it's a worthwhile cost because we're otherwise losing much more than that. And just the final statistics about 24 in 100,000, that comes to about 0.024 by percentage every year. Average lifespan for a male is about 73 years and yes. 78 for females. So you put about 75 years. You times 0.024 to 75, your lifetime risk of actually dying on the road itself, not just having an accident and escaping lucky like you, Dr. George, it's about 1.8%.
Wow, that's high.
Just to think about it, each of us have a 1.8% of actually dying on the road. And that's just the roads we're talking. We're not talking about voluntary jumping off buildings or industrial injuries or assaults and et cetera.
And we're worried about heart disease and cancer. And
yeah, so non-communicable disease have been given a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. And yeah, of course, rightfully so. But you have to die from a heart disease or a stroke or a sepsis or something, definitely. But you don't have to die from trauma. And that's a premature cause of death. And that's something that I wish and hope that, I guess the whole trauma community hopes that the government as a whole gives a lot of emphasis on trying to focus on.
That was a very powerful message.
It was, yeah. In the spirit of Chinese New Year, I think before you press on that accelerator because you're running late, just remember you don't want to add to the statistics that Dr. Shah talked about.
Yep.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Shah Johan Muhammad Yusuf, consultant emergency and trauma physician from Hospital Sungai Buloh, together with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in our Doctor in the House series, talking about trauma response to road accidents on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.